To see examples of what we talked about on this episode, along with further information, go to bunchofdorks.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to
Two Dimension Podcast,
the comic book podcast
with no direction. All right, you've heard the song. You know who we are. I'm Don Moore, and sitting across from me is someone who is not repressed by existing ideas. That can only be...
Al. Maybe.
Good to see you, buddy.
Yeah, man. Back again.
Yeah, back again.
One of those meandering shows that we have no idea where they're going to go. It could turn into a B-movie show or a music show.
I love those.
But we're going to start out, try to start as a comic book show.
Yeah.
We're going to try. We found a new comic shop.
Yeah, let's give them a shout out.
I found it, but you've taken more advantage of it than I have.
It's funny how things work out. We've actually, Rook and Al and myself, have gotten several shows together trying to take advantage of the fact that school wasn't started. Now Rook's in charge of the band boosters, so his life is not his own this season. So we were trying to get as many shows together as we could. And since then, we've had Hurricane Irma come through. A lot of people have actually sent in notes asking of concern. Thank you very much. Everybody turned out okay. It was nerve-wracking, and instead of a Category 4 or 5, which is supposed to hit us, we got a Category 1. Some people tell me it was almost a Category 2. We made it out okay. I'm sorry about the people down south, and I have to say I'm very sorry for the people of Puerto Rico.
Yeah, we're lucky we didn't get that. We would have been trashed.
And if you can send any kind of assistance to Puerto Rico, find a service you trust and try to help out, because that's just devastating. Anyway, you went to Tampa because of the storm.
Well, here's the story. I'll just tell it quickly.
Sure.
Right before the storm was going to hit, we didn't know where it was going to hit. It was going to hit the East Coast, West Coast. Now it's heading to the West Coast. Okay. So I got people calling me, telling me, you got to get out. And I'm like, but I'm not in an evacuation zone.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, no, but the flooding and this and that. And then I go, look, and God bless them. You know what I mean? I'm glad they cared enough to, and they helped. They did help me. So basically, like, we didn't even have the windows boarded up. So one Saturday, Giles cozy. We got a hotel room for you. Get out of there. I go, okay. So we drove up to Ocala. The only hotel they could find me, and you know, like I said, God bless them, was just the nastiest hotel you'll ever want to be in. If you're in Ocala,
Please.
Well, don't go to a hotel on Silver Springs Boulevard.
Yeah.
One of these little motels. Stay away. Go to a nice hotel if you can, because there was no hotels to be found in town.
Yeah, of course.
So anyway, we go there. Within like a day, the roof was leaking. The woman was going to kick us out on Monday, which was when the storm was hitting, because we only got us 2 days. Ended up, Giles said, okay, you can stay with us at where I work at the assisted living. So we stayed at the assisted living. It didn't hit that bad there, but the power didn't go out of the assisted living place, but it went out all over the place. So within a day, power was coming back up there. So, but we weren't ready to go. It was like by Wednesday, we were like, well, what should we do? He goes, well, let's just stay. We got a hotel room. We'll stay. So we stayed in an actual hotel room. Next day, we said, well, it's Thursday. We had called a guy, a friend of ours, a realtor. He said, yeah, we got power already. And I go, well, let's just stay here. If we can find a room for Thursday, we'll stay here. We'll come back on Friday. That way, we'll make sure that everything's okay. Got another hotel room. This is on my hotel room tour. We're already talking about it. 1, 2, 3, 4 places we stayed at. Okay. So we stay there. The place didn't have any cable. Cable was out. I can't say the name of the cable company, but I used to work for the company. Anyway, you figure it out. So anyway, so we come back on Thursday. Got back here. There's no power. So my neighbor, it's 200 yards away, has power, and we don't.
Yeah.
Why? Within 4 hours of being here, it was 90 degrees in the house.
Yeah.
So my mom's like dying. So we found a place in Tampa. And we had a little bit, it was a little bit, I had to get directions, but thankfully this one really nice woman working at a beauty salon gave me like a printout, a computer printout. I found it. So we were there for a couple of days. You know, by the first day I'm bored already. So I go, well, I need to get a book because I didn't bring my comics or anything. So I go there and I go, well, there's got to be something on this main drag. So I get on Kennedy. I get on Kennedy and I'm looking. I'm going south. I'm looking and I don't see anything. And then I see the Tampa Bay 13, T13. And I go, oh, there's Channel 13. Nothing. So then I turn around and I'm going back north. And as I'm driving, I keep looking to the right and I see Dollar Comics. And I went, oh, I passed it. So I went around, turned around, and went inside. And there was this really, there's a little cool comic shop. Sure enough, they had a ton of Dollar Comics, and we'll talk about them later in the show. And, you know, the guy was a real nice guy, and, you know, bought some comics and old-school comics to get me through a couple of days, so it was fun. So then the comic shop, I don't have his card, but I think what was the name of the comic shop?
I think Comics Plus, wasn't it? It's on the sidebar of our blog.
Yeah. I just remember Dollar Comics is more like eye-catching title than the title of the store, but I know I have his card there or whatever.
As soon as Al told me about it, I went there.
But anyway, they had a ton of Dollar Comics, some really good stuff, and they had all the new books and stuff like that. And it's a guy who's just starting out. He started out in April, and he's definitely, if you're in the Tampa area, it's on Kennedy Street.
And Comics and Stuff.
It's called Comics and Stuff? Okay.
Comics and Stuff. Peddlers of Picture Books.
That's it. It's a really good place that you need to check out. And Don's been there.
Twice.
And Don called me on that day. And I said, hey, I found a comic shop here. And you're like, yeah? And then as I'm coming home the next day on Saturday, you went up there to the comic shop.
Yeah.
Now you tell your story.
I went up there and I had a blast. It's a small shop. It's a really clean shop.
Yeah.
And you know, as soon as I walked in, the guy spoke to me, and it's—I have to say, one thing Al always brings up is to him, a comic shop is more like a pub. It's not just a place to buy comics; it's to see like-minded people, and you could stay and talk. You know, which in most cases it's been that way. There's some comic shops that I've had to go to that I didn't feel that way, but you know, I went in, and immediately the guy was talking, and he said, "Are you looking for anything?" I was looking for Mr. Miracle 2. You're doing Mr. Miracle again for DC, and it's kind of hard to find. And he said, oh, yeah, I got it over here, and he pulled it for me. And then we talked. I remember he said, he asked me if I was reading metal. I said, what Rook was talking about, the Batman metal or DC metal. I said, no, I'm really not interested in it. And he understood. He was just thinking I would be. But he said he never really liked DC, never read them. He was a Marvel guy. And then he said, now I'm more of an Image guy. But I don't know, I really had a good time talking to him. You know, we talked about things here and there. And then one plus to me was Al had told me about the Legion of Superheroes and Batman 66 that Mike Allred drew. Well, after telling me that, I've looked everywhere for it. I've never found it. And the guy said, anything else you're looking for? And I told him that book. And he said, I have it. He says, I don't think I have it on the wall anymore. He says, I haven't sold it, so I put three of them in the dollar boxes. And he was going to go look. I said, no, it's okay. I'm going to go up to the dollar boxes after I looked at, you know, the new books. Man, I'll tell you, dollar box palooza. It's not just, I guess I'd say it's stuff that he wasn't selling, but it was some prime stuff. And I don't know, it's not, a lot of times, there's a lot of stores here with great dollar boxes, as you know if you listen to the show. But this guy, it's not just some things nobody wants. It's stuff that somebody wants. Mm-hmm. And all kinds, old comics, new comics. But I was there going through a couple hours maybe. Different people were coming to the store. I'd listen to them, talk to the customers. And finally, when I paid, he and I were talking again. And he said, oh, by the way, did you find that Batman 66 and Legion of Superheroes? I says, no, I didn't. I says, I found three copies of Supergirl and the Legion of Superheroes. I guess that's just a series now. A lot of different people, the Legion. But
Batman 66 meeting a lot of people.
Well, this one is Legion of Superheroes meeting a lot of people.
Oh, so it's not them meeting Batman, it was them meeting other people.
Okay. Yeah, well, they met Batman 66. That's the Allred issue that I bought.
Yeah.
But then they had a Supergirl meets the Legion, which I looked at, I wasn't interested in. And then he said, no. He says, I understand, but I... And he walks, let me look. He says, I know, I have an idea where I put it. I guess I missed that box, because he immediately pulled it out. So I was getting money out of my pocket to give it. No, just take it. Well, that's a score. You know, so anyway, I bought so many books that I put some back. And I thought, you know, I really wanted to get some other ones that I saw in there. So I went back last Saturday. He and I talked a long time. I got another big stack. And again, I'm wanting to go back again. I was actually hoping when I contacted you, say, hey, can we go to the store? Well, let's do a road show.
Whatever you want.
But I didn't know what was going on. But yeah, he sells on eBay. So I put him, after I talked, I told him about the podcast. I says, I'm going to put you on a sidebar of the blog. So if you look down, we have comic sellers. We have Yancey. We have Wilson's Book World. And we have comics and stuff. So you can contact him through there. He sells on eBay, and I guess if you're looking for something, you can ask him. And what he told me is if he doesn't have it, he can get it. He's got contacts with other people, and he's also, I guess, really close to the Yancey Street store in Oldsmar. And
he
even told me to, you know, check them out. And he said they helped him out, because I guess when he opened, he needed some more dollar boxes. And he says he contacted the guy, and the guy said, oh, here. And he sold him some long boxes for dollar books.
Wow.
He says, and they weren't just garbage. They were, you know, so, I don't know. I like that everybody's helping each other out.
Yeah, some of them anyway. You know.
Well, yeah, but...
You know, the other yeah. ones are. Yeah. They know who they are,
there's,
too.
There's a lot more than one. But no, it's, I'll tell you, I'm really happy. I can't say enough about it, so... Hurricanes are bad, but sometimes you find really awesome comic shops.
So Tampa must have a bunch of comic shops then,
well,
right? Because I know they got...
Yancey, they got Nerd Out, they got...
Yancey's in Tampa? Oh, is Oldsmar? Tampa?
Oldsmar, to me, is a different place, but I guess parts of it are right by Tampa. I guess if we lived up there, it'd be close. But he was telling me just right down the street.
He said,
because I said, well, I told him how you and I found Nerd Out Comics, and I said we were looking for Crystal, and then,
yeah, Crystal Burger, yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
Then we saw Nerd Out Comics, as we were going to go to Yancey, but I said it was Oldsmar. I thought it was long. No, it's just, you just drive down there. He says, I understand it's an Oldsmar address, but it's really Tampa.
Oh, okay. I don't know Tampa. You may know it better than I do. I have no clue.
Yeah.
I don't know one thing about Tampa. And that road there, Kennedy, one time I was looking for a place to go. I had to go to a job interview, and I hit the wrong street, and I ended up on a highway. And I'm like, oh, no.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you got to be really careful, because some streets just turn into highways, and then you're, like, going somewhere for a long time that you don't want to go.
Well, it's like if you drive downtown St. Pete, it's the same thing. It's
isn't it?
It's
kind of
like Dr. Seuss designed the city.
Yeah, or Dr. Doom, maybe, or Dr. Demento. I don't know. But, yeah, it's just like, oh, man. So I kind of hugged that. I was going to get real, like, experimental and go down the street. I go, no, let me just stay on this street. There's got to be something here. There's so many... small businesses on here. Somebody's got to be here, and he might be the only guy around there, you know?
Yeah, Holly dated a guy in high school, and he lived on the south side of St. Pete. It was a really nice area by the water. And sometimes she got out of school, she'd ride the bus and go to his place. And so I get out of class, and I have to go pick her up. And I'd always have to call, stop somewhere. I didn't have a cell phone at the time. I have to call the parents to find out, can you give me directions? Every single time. And then we had those handheld GPS things. I'd always have to type the address in. And I swear, every time I went, the neighborhood was different. It's like the roads would change. And I get there, and the mother, I really liked his parents quite a bit. And the mother said, yeah, it's confusing here. It's not a regular, and that's why I always make the joke, it's like Dr. Seuss designed the town. I'm sure if you live there, it'd make perfect sense.
Sure?
But if you're an outsider and you're you know, you're tired and you're trying to get somewhere.
Yeah, no, definitely, yeah. Right. So, you know, those are, well, every once in a while you find a little comic shop somewhere, you know. I mean, I guess we talked about this before, but at least with comic shops, it's the only place where you're going to find the new books to buy. And yeah. They don't sell them anywhere else, so I guess there's still a market for comic shops. Unfortunately, you know, the business isn't doing that great. I mean, he even told me, I mean, I couldn't believe he said this, but he goes, yeah, it's kind of like a dead, you know, business or whatever, but I want to get in it because I love comics. I go, well, that's the only reason to do it.
Yeah, and you can tell. Comics. Yeah, you can tell he loves them.
Because if you really want to go get into this and make a big bucks, you know, chances are you're not going to, but you'll maybe make a living if you run a good store and, you know, run a tight ship. It doesn't seem to be overburdened with books there. He seems to be pretty lean and mean in the store, you know what I mean? So
I'd even asked him, I says, how do you decide what goes in the dollar box? And basically, he's moving stock. He says, if something's not selling, he throws it in. I think some of it, as we always say, the dollar box is what brings you into the store, you know? And he was talking about later plans, some of the things he might do. Under the new books, he's talking about getting short shelves to put some back issue boxes, you were thinking. Yeah. But I don't know. I never looked at it as a dead business. I guess it kind of is because you have to be people like us to go into the shops.
I don't think of it that way, but,
well,
you know.
Like I said, it has to be people like us to go into those shops. And unless there's some other reason. Yancey's moved. They're not in the mall anymore. But to me, the mall was one thing because people could come in and they could see all the, besides the comics, they could see all the merchandise, all the action figures, statues, t-shirts.
Yeah, it becomes like a big old convention. By the way, there's MegaCon going on now, believe it or not.
Yeah, they do it twice a year now, I think.
Oh, I thought it was only once a year. And Stan Lee came back.
Yeah.
And Shatner. I saw something on Bay News 9, and I'm like, oh, there's another one?
Yeah, it's all, you know, they've been doing that, I think the last time you and I and Dez went, they had it always, what was it, March?
It was in March, yeah.
Yeah, but they have another one like every 6 months now. Because that year they had another one, and Dez was asking if I was going to go. I says, well, no, not really. It seems to me like, I mean, I always had a good time when I went. I found things, but it seems to me like they're kind of getting out of comics. You know, they're concentrating a lot on media guests, you know, TV people and stuff. And
they showed a woman on TV dressed as Wonder Woman. She was a cosplayer. She goes, yeah, I like to dress up, but I'm really here for the comics. And I'm like, well, that's good. Glad to hear it.
Well, but every year when you and I, Dallas and myself went, that first year, when saying that, I got tons of stuff. But
the first year was awesome.
Well, I didn't think it was awesome. I had a good time, but it seemed to me like all the dealers had a bunch of the same books. They had the same 20 comic books that nobody could sell. And because I was looking for back issues of stuff I was trying to find.
Wasn't the first year when you found, like, the for $10, the Essential, the Marvel hardcovers?
That was
the
second year.
Okay, that was the awesome one. Then.
Yeah, the second year, that's the one that had that guy that had that store that was like a bookstore. They had all those $5
trades. Yeah, yeah. Was that the one we saw Nick Carty, too, at the second one?
Yeah, the second
That one. Was a good one.
Yeah.
That was a good one.
The first, and when I say that, I had a good time.
The first one was the birth of the show.
Yeah, yeah. The first one was, if you haven't heard us say this before, Dallas was always trying to get me to do the podcast, and I, no. But we got to know Al at work, and then one day, I've never been to MegaCon. You know, I always had my daughter with me, and, you know, a parent with a kid. But she was at college, and all of a sudden I had, you know, time and money. And Dallas is talking about we could go to MegaCon. And, you know, I'd always heard stories about, you know, you have to buy a ticket and then you have to pay for parking and everything. And Dallas said, well, we could carpool and share the parking.
Yeah.
And then I got to talk because me and you and Dallas, whenever we talk, it was always great. And I said, maybe we could get Al to go. And Dallas said, that's what I was thinking. We could ask him. And I asked, you were interested. So the three of us went. I'll be honest with you, I never had so much fun in my life. We stopped to eat, and we drove. Orlando's about an hour and a half away from us. And then we did the show. I mean, not the show. We went through there and bought stuff.
We didn't record that, did we?
No, there was no podcast, even.
Yeah, we didn't record
And then on the way back, Al and I start talking, besides comics, about rock bands. We're talking about progressive rock bands, stuff that we both liked in the 70s. And I remember Dallas saying, I had no idea what you guys were talking. But the conversation never stopped the whole time. And then Monday rolls around. You know, we're back at work, and then Dallas says, "Don, let's do a podcast." And instead of just rolling my eyes and dismissing it, I said, "Could Al do it with us?" And Dallas said, "Yeah, I was going to ask him too. I'm in." Before, honestly, I always pictured the podcast as Beavis and Butthead, you know, like comics, you know, or Chris Farley interviewing Paul McCartney. Hey, you remember when? You know, I just couldn't see filling up all this time. But, yeah, it worked out really well. But, yeah, the MegaCon was the birth of the podcast.
The first one was the first of the podcast. The second one was the awesome one.
That's the one we did.
Was that the one with the recorded it or the cassette deck?
Yeah, when I say this, I fully admit it. Al was talking about we could record in the car. We didn't know what we were doing. And I said, we were recording off Dallas's computer. And he goes, I got a cassette, a Walkman that records. Oh, that's stupid. Don't do that. Well, I'm glad Al didn't listen to me because he brought the recorder. And it was a handheld recorder. Dallas is driving. I'm sitting in the back seat. And Al just turns it on, and whoever's talking's holding the recorder while we're driving down I-4. And I'm like, what is this? And then Dallas is trying to get me to talk, and I'm, you know, I hate to say it, I was being like, oh, come on. And they'd hand it to me. So the first half of the episode, I'm not really talking too much. I'm talking a bit. And then when we're coming back, I was elated. I got to meet Nick Carty, which was super awesome.
Yeah.
And it was fun. I didn't think this thing would turn out. It turned out, actually, I mean.
It was listenable.
The early, yeah, and that's the key word. In those early episodes we did, when I'm saying this, almost the first
50.
Yeah, well, 50 or 60 episodes we did. There's a few that are completely unlistenable because somebody gave Dallas a mixing board that didn't work, and Dallas insisted on using it.
Yeah.
And only the strong can get through those few episodes. But the rest of it, the quality is not quite there. Not that we've ever had high quality, but
yeah, and Brooke had the headphones that would. With the microphone.
Yeah, and it'd pick up all the scratching and stuff like that. Yeah. But I was just as bad.
Oh, there's so many goofy things. What was the one time? I remember one time I went to Orlando. It might have been the third visit. And we stopped to eat breakfast. And there was some smart, wise guy waitress there. And I remember, like, I had to go to the bathroom or something. And didn't she go to you guys, hey.
Oh, she was
go
so
out,
awesome.
Go outside. And it'll scare the crap out of him when he comes back in here. Yeah.
No. This waitress was the most awesome waitress in the world. She was she just had a presence to her. She was a small woman.
Yeah.
But we were walking, she was coming towards us. We were being seated, and she was talking to this group of people in Spanish, and she could really project, even though she was so small. It kind of scared me. She ended up being our waitress.
Al
had to go to the bathroom, and then, you know, this is when we were paying, and she just kind of made a joke to us. She always referred to us as boys.
Yeah.
Hi, boys. But she came up and goes, this is, he's not here, he pays the check.
Yeah,
you know?
That was it. That
she
was
had
it.
So much, and
that was it.
Then, what was it? We were waiting. You came back, and we were going to pay. And then she said, what was it? You said, hold on, you were wanting to do something. So Dez and I got up to pay, and we were walking by, and she was carrying a big tray of food, a little tiny lady. And she saw us, and she goes, hi, boys, have a good day. And then I told Dez when she was walking towards you, I said, oh, man, Dez, you know what's going to happen now? He says, we're not going to be there, and Al's going to be making time with her in Spanish. We need to go back. And Dez kept laughing. I loved her.
I remember that.
Yeah, it was fun. It's fun to do stuff with your friends.
It's fun to. I remember all this.
Anyway.
So anyway, back to the original point of this show, which is comic books.
Well, I'm going to beat the dead horse here.
Oh, that one.
Valerian on the Frontiers. One. Well, I'm actually behind. I've started buying up the single albums again. Now, one thing is about four books back. That's when he went back to the 80s. You know, they were always in the future. And I was always surprised seeing these in French, not being able to read them. Like, why was he back in the 80s? You know, they're time pilots, but they stayed. Loreline was in the ship, or Loreline, and Valerian was in France in the 80s, in England, in Russia. And because of a time paradox, they had to stop something. And so Galaxity, the group they work with, no longer exists. They basically met God. They met God, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit, the Trinity. But it wasn't like what we thought. And they always said they don't think it was, but some type of a paradox. And they made a deal that the world wouldn't be destroyed if Galaxy didn't exist. And so they went back to the 80s, but Loreline made a deal with them that they could keep the ship. And Loreline said, well, that was the only way I could keep you. You know, it's if you had the ship, you'd be happy. So anyway, in this episode, it's after all that's occurred, and they're basically dealing with Chernobyl. You know, Valerian's in Russia. He's basically working as a mercenary, trying to find information and stop things, working for these organizations. Well, Mr. Albert is the main character in this. He's been in all of them. He's an older man, and he's French. And I have to say, I really love Mr. Albert. He's just a strong character. He's like a real person. And in this book, though, it starts out with Valerian in Russia, but it has this, it also shows the same thing J.C. Mezier always draws, is these alien societies in another part of the galaxy, and they're on this giant, it's kind of like Fifth Element, they're on a giant cruise ship, which you've never seen that part. I can't believe you've never seen Fifth Element, dude.
I saw part of it at your house.
Yeah, but towards the end of it, they go on a cruise ship, which is basically an intergalactic cruise ship. Well, that's in here. And there's this armored couple, and they're talking about the different races and this and that. And anyway, the male cheats the female. She finds out something. I'm not going to give it away. But then he leaves. He takes her power and goes. Well, he ends up showing up on 1980s France. And Valerian and Loreline are dealing with him. And at one point in the story, Valerian tells Mr. Albert, I've got to go. I can't stay here. And they pull the ship out of hiding and go into space. The reason these two guys did this story was because of that lawsuit was started with George Lucas. It's after, you know, Mezieres was upset when he saw Star Wars that they took.
So was Jack Kirby, by the way.
Yeah. Well, when I say this, the original three Star Wars movies, to me, I hold in high regard. They're some of my favorites. They live with me. George Lucas and Steven Spielberg, they love Jack Kirby. They love Carl Barks, even though they didn't know his name. There's a lot of things they love that they put into the work. I see similarities. I can see where they got the inspiration for it. Star Wars is its own animal. And a lot of people were afraid when the Valerian movie came out that people would think they'd rip off Star Wars. I haven't heard that. What I always heard was people reference the fact that Star Wars got a lot out of Valerian, which is true. But like I said, it wasn't a ripoff. They made their own thing. Nevertheless, Mezieres and Christian was really upset about, you know, that they took stuff, especially when Princess Leia was in the Iron Bikini, which Loreline was in one of the earlier volumes. So they decided, since nothing was coming to this, that what they were going to do was take Valerian out of space and bring him back to the 80s. Now, one thing it created was a paradox, because the City of Shifting Waters, it was after the second story of Valerian, when they went back to 1986, after the world was destroyed by a giant tsunami, and they were in New York, in a flooded New York. And now in this story, it basically ends at that same time, they're in 1986. And basically, he prevents the tsunami. You know, what caused the tsunami. And so that's why Galaxity never existed.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
About the lawsuit? So J.C. Mezier, we've talked about this before, but again, I don't remember. And later on, I'm going to tell you all the famous movies besides The Fifth Element that I've never seen. So people can go, oh, you never saw that. Did they win? Did they sue George Lucas, and or did they win any money from him?
No, I think there was a lawsuit they put in, and it didn't get through. When I'm saying this, I don't know if George Lucas is even aware. I think George Lucas had a...
In the set designers?
Yeah. I think a lot of the artists were, well, they say a lot of the artists were huge Valerian fans.
We talked about this
before. Now, the Dargald USA put out 4 Valerian volumes in 1982 to 86. That's when I read these. And the earlier ones. And on the back, it had a thing about see what the American cartoonists say. You know, Walt Simonson was one of them. Kelly Freas was one of them. But they talked about, Gil Kane. Gil Kane said, I've been a longtime fan of Valerian and Loreline for a long time, so now I can read them, you know. But Walt Simonson, his early work was heavily influenced by J.C. Mezier's.
Alien.
Yeah, but even earlier than that, I mean, he had a lot of the lines and work, and he talks about all the time. Well, that's an inspiration, but, I mean, you never see Walt Simonson's work and think, oh, he's ripping off Mezier's. He took what he liked and put it in.
Because Mezier's draws people differently than Simonson does.
But I'll tell you, I love Valerian because I love seeing alien cultures and even primitive cultures that Mezier's draws, and each one's different. It's not like he's just got one stock thing that he keeps doing over and over. But I'll tell you, this man can draw modern society that we live in like you're in it. I mean, all the cars and the ships and the heavy equipment. He's something. You know, I'm saying that. I'm really glad that Valerian is going back into space again after, 4 or 5 for these albums. I enjoyed them. But I didn't want him just to go to that. But that's why they said it was a reaction that if you're going to show space, we're going to stop giving you ideas and we're going
to
go back.
He goes back to space in the next volume, right?
Yeah, it goes back.
The Living Weapons was the next volume,
yeah.
I think.
And the album Circles of Power.
Oh.
Oh, you all right?
Yeah.
And Hostages of Ultralum. Those were when he was doing Fifth Element. And what the story with that, Circles of Power, you see a taxi cab here.
Yeah.
Well, what
happened? Yeah, I get it.
Luc Besson was wanting to work with Mobius and J.C. Mezier's. And he went to him and says, you know, every movie, science fiction movie that's come out since the 70s has either been you've worked on or you directly influenced these movies from your work. He says, you should have your own. We should do one. And both Mobius and J.C. Mezier's said, of course. So they worked on Fifth Element. But Corbin, I can't remember his name, Corbin, it was the guy Bruce Willis played. When they first started the movie, he was supposed to work in a rocket ship factory. He was an employee there. And then but Luc Besson couldn't get the financing for the film, so they stopped. They stopped work on it. J.C. Mezier's and P. Christian just, we got to get back to work. So they started doing more Valerian work volumes. That's what he did, Circles of Power. Well, Valerian and Loreline. They
Tigra.
Yeah, well, you get used to reading something in your head, how it is.
For 30 years, you said Loreline.
Yeah. And then you find out that the French call it Loreline. Yeah. That's one thing I didn't know this, I think it's funny. Loreline's not a French name. It's not a name. It's something they made up for the...
Oh, really?
I've known girls named Loreline, I think, or something like that, or something close, but they said there was no women with that name when they gave it to her. And then a year after the volumes came out, all of a sudden they started registering girls in France being born Loreline. Now there's a lot of Lorelines in France. But I've never been, but I love you, France. And thanks for all your help in the revolution.
And thanks for selling us the Louisiana.
Oh, the Louisiana Purchase.
Louisiana Purchase. Thank you for Louisiana.
And thank you
for jazz and all that, I guess.
Yeah, well, thank you for that very awesome statue you gave us with Michael Eiffel.
Awesome statue, yeah.
Michael Eiffel designed
the
support.
French fries.
Did they really come up with those?
I don't know. I'm just saying. I don't know. French bread.
We do love French fries, but you got some awesome movies that I've seen. I love your cartoonist, and you guys really play good soccer. So my hat is off to France.
Yes, and we lost another biggie this week. They're indirectly connected with comics because there were comics in his magazine. Hugh Hefner passed away, yeah. Man. There were he did Annie Fanny, and there was always comics and stuff like that. So that's like a, and he was buddies with Forrest Ackerman, the guy from Famous Monsters. So yeah,
that's.
We're losing him every week, man.
Hugh Hefner was one. He wasn't a big part of my life, but
no.
When I was a kid, Playboy was something forbidden. I was from a religious family anyway.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
sometimes
yeah.
I'd be at somebody's house, or I had an uncle that had them, and he would what do you call it? Sometimes you try to peek, but whenever your cousins or something would peek in these magazines, all they'd want to see was the forbidden part, was the naked ladies.
Sure.
You know? And so I was surprised to find it. Everybody was made a joke about Playboy. I only read it for the articles, you know. But when I was in the military, everybody had Playboy, Penthouse, Hustler. I mean, they sold them on the ship.
Sure.
And so everybody had stacks of them. They were everywhere. You couldn't not read them. And I have to say, the articles were pretty strong. What was it? Alex Haley wrote articles, you know. I mean, they had, in the cartoonists, they had Roland B. Wilson. They had Doug Sneed.
Gahan Wilson.
Huh?
Gahan Wilson.
Yeah, but no, Roland B. Wilson was my favorite.
That's a different guy.
Yeah.
Gahan Wilson wasn't good. Who's the horror guy, Gahan Wilson?
Yeah.
Was he in Playboy? He probably was.
He did some things in one of those magazines. He also was with National Lampoon.
Yeah,
Gahan Wilson.
Yeah.
You know,
that guy that we didn't
Doug Sneed.
Doug Sneed, the Dead saw that we didn't see at the MegaCon.
And I never thought his name was Sneed. I always thought it was Ferd. Everybody called him Ferd or Freud because his signature doesn't look like Sneed.
Jack Cole did drawings for him.
Well, there's an article online they were talking about was that Comics Cube had a piece, and they were talking about Jack Cole was. And I do agree with this. He was one of the most fantastic cartoonists.
Sure
this
was.
Plastic Man was second to none.
Sure was.
But he said, what was it? That basically after the Wortham hearings, Jack Cole was one of the main culprits of it because he drew that horror magazine of the guy with injecting something in his eyeball.
Oh, the eye injury to eyeball,
And that was always the poster boy of the Wortham hearings. They kept bringing that up. But basically, Jack Cole was leaving comics. He was gone. He was going to go into advertising and other work. And then Hugh Hefner was the one that brought him back doing the comics. But Hugh Hefner was a huge comic book fan. I guess mostly Golden Age stuff. But I was shocked to find out Playboy had such a strong comic section. And wasn't he the one that financed Humbug?
Was he? Yeah, probably. If he was connected with Kurtzman,
I think.
Annie Fanny,
There was, I don't know if it was Humbug or Help. There was one of those books where Kurtzman put out, and I guess they did two issues of it. And but Hefner was the financing behind it. Of course, it didn't do well, so they dropped it. But he always gave some of these guys a lot of work.
All the great cartoonists worked for Playboy. Roth. Was that
Arnold
guy?
Roth, yeah.
Yeah, that guy. Annie Fanny had everybody working on Frazetta, Will Elder, Kurtzman, Jack Davis, you name it. They worked for. Oh, this friend sent me a panel from EC, and I want to post it on. I want to give you a copy of it and post it on. It was the weirdest panel, one of the weirdest panels you'll see, and I have no idea where this image came from, but it was drawn by Jack Davis, and I want to see if somebody can identify. The book. Maybe that's something we'll do. Like, I'll find a panel from the book that I don't identify this panel or whatever because it's a very strange image. We'll post it later, you know. But that's a drag, man. But, you know, what are you going to do? I mean, I'm sure we're missing other people, you know, but that was the latest, biggest person.
Len Wein. And we've talked about him before on the show, even recently, but. Len Wein went away. Marty Pascal wrote one of the most beautiful things on Facebook because I guess, you know, him and Len Wein were close. I think Len Wein hired him. And it was really beautiful what he said. But Len Wein, I was surprised, I'm an artist guy. You know, Alan, I always talk about this. I buy the comics for the art. I like stories. But it's rare for me to buy a book because of the writer. I have to say before, never, but as I've gotten older, there's been a few writers I've picked up. Of course, at the same time, most of the time I like the artwork anyway. But I was shocked to find out just how much Len Wein did. He was on an episode of Fanboy Radio, and actually, that's kind of how I found out Dallas liked comics. Dallas and I always talked about bands all the time and guitar players. And then one day I was listening at Fanboy Radio, and I was telling another friend of mine about this guy. He says, he co-created Swamp Thing, he created Wolverine. And I was just going down the list of stuff that I didn't realize he did. And I was telling about all the comics he wrote and kept going, like The Incredible Hulk and everything else. And I didn't realize all these things that I knew about the characters were stories written by. And then Dallas goes, are you talking about Len Wein? He just walked by and said, how do you know Len Wein? Oh, I like comic books. Well, there you go. But he never lost that excitement, a youthful excitement for comics. And Scott Kurtz, another cartoonist, called in acting like he was some nerd fan. And Len Wein just let his hair down and went with it, you know. And finally, when they were asking his questions, he says, look, you guys can make fun of it. He says, but I'm in the comic shop every Wednesday having these same conversations you're making fun of right now. And I don't know. It was a blast. That's when I realized, Len Wein was the guy that brought Alan Moore in to do Watchmen. Len Wein was the editor of the Watchmen comic. He was the reason that, supposedly, they didn't have a letter. They were going to have a letters page in the Watchmen comic book. But, you know, as you always know, it's like three or four issues before the letter page comes out. And, you know, it was going to be a 12-issue series anyway. And Len Wein, he said that he talked to Alan, you got something so unique here. We don't really need a letters page. Why don't you have some type of, write-up while you're doing it? Well, he wasn't expecting what Alan Moore did. You know, he wrote all those, like Night Owl talking about his old, book, Under the Hood.
Oh, yeah.
Dave Gibbons did all those illustrations. But they had Rorschach and the New Frontiersman, that magazine. So at the end of each issue was like, two, three, four pages giving you more information. It was incredible. But supposedly that was Len Wein that came up with it. There was a lot of things that he did. One time we mentioned him when the four of us were on a show, and Rook just said, why haven't we ever talked about Len Wein? You cast a long shadow, and from what Marty Pascal said, you had a lot of health issues, which I didn't know about.
I know recently he did. I don't know about all the time.
I think he'd always had it, the way people, reading on Facebook, people. That was another thing. He never seemed like a sickly health issue person. He seemed like a bright, vibrant, It's what he showed. That's what he had. But I think he always dealt with health issues.
Oh, okay.
But
yeah, well, what are you going to do?
But anyway.
Enjoy his work, I think.
Yeah,
read his
well,
comics.
Listen, you may not even know his name, but his work was far-reaching. You've read things that were either written by him or influenced by him, or you're reading stuff, an extension of what other people have written from it. He's not hard to find. His work is everywhere. So
yeah.
What's your favorite? Do you have a favorite Len Wein piece?
Yeah, it would probably be the when I bought it when I was a kid at the flea market. It was the House of Mystery was the first Swamp Thing story. That's probably my favorite thing. Because I remember when I saw it, I was like taken away by the artwork on it. And I'm like, oh man, this is amazing. And then that got me into rights and into buying the book, and they're all fantastic. So yeah, it would be Swamp Thing.
Yeah, I knew his name before that. I knew the name Len Wein.
Fanzines.
But Swamp Thing was the one that made me realize who he was.
Yeah.
He also wrote, he was the one that put together the new X-Men.
Yeah.
And he wrote Giant Size X-Men number one with Dave Cockrum.
Yeah.
And then, I don't think he wrote the regular book. I think Chris Claremont took over after that.
Probably.
But, I mean, the new X-Men was Len Wein.
See, I don't remember even seeing that book on the stands. My buddy Pat says he saw it on the stands. Because X-Men was reprints for a bunch of years, remember? They stopped doing new ones, and they were just reprinting them. And then one day he saw it, and I was like, and he bought it, and I don't know whatever he did with it.
That was a hard book to find.
Was it Giant Size X-Men?
Yeah, well, all of them, because The big thing was, I see there was a Marvel ad about the X-Men go international. And they had a drawing. I didn't know it was Dave Cockrum or I would have had a heart attack. But I was interested. I liked that. I was always interested in X-Men. Of course, I pick up an issue, and I guess it was Warner Roth. I only saw a few of them. I saw the first issue, the King-Size X-Men, where the X-Men fight the Avengers. Mm. I saw that in Iowa Park, Texas. It was like a little market store. And they had two comic racks, and I saw that, and I just was fascinated. Jack Kirby drew it. I'm like, what? But, you know, I couldn't get the comic. I had no money. And then, I started seeing the international in the first Marvel calendar they put out in 1974. It had a thing about X-Men go international, and they showed Storm was from Africa, Wolverine was Canada, which I knew Wolverine because of the Incredible Hulk. They had a Nightcrawler was from Germany. They had all these different characters. And I said, wow, why can't I find this comic? I never saw the comic till December of 1976. I saw it in Wichita Falls, Texas.
Oh, wow.
And I'm like, wow. But it had been out for a while, and I jumped up and down finding out it was Dave Cockrum. And I went back and found old issues. And when that first comic store opened up in Oklahoma, I'd go in there, and the guy that owned the store was talking to a couple of other people, you know, older than I was. And they were talking. I said, yeah, X-Men was really hard. It's been a hard comic book to find. Of course, he had them there on his rack. He had all the comics. But it was hard to find. I never saw it. And I'm talking about from Oklahoma to Texas. I go to different convenience stores. I've never seen X-Men until that time in end of 76.
I remember when I was younger buying the Neil Adams X-Men at stores and the Steranko X-Men at stores, but I never bought any of the reprint ones.
Yeah.
That was weird. Why did they do that? They went up to a certain point, and then for like three or four, maybe even longer years, they just went reprints of the early issues. I don't understand why they did that.
Well, they wouldn't have to pay creators anymore.
Yeah, why did they just cancel the book?
I don't know.
Yeah. I remember the first issue of X-Men I bought was with the Banshee. It was like 29 or something like that. That's how far back that goes.
I read the story. Sometimes I think the reason it kept going was because Roy Thomas liked it so much. Mm-hmm. And I think, it's just a guess, but I've said this on the show before, Conan. You know, Roy Thomas is a huge Conan fan. He's wanting to do it. They got the licensing fee for it. And him and Barry Smith was doing those issues. And then, I don't know, I think it was after the seventh issue or they were going to cancel it. And then Roy Thomas went to Stan Lee really upset. And I guess Stan Lee realized that it meant something to Roy. And he said, let me talk to Martin. And he went to Martin Goodman's office. And Roy Thomas said he was just playing a car dealership game. He says, Martin Goodman had no idea. He was just looking at sales. And he says, it was Stan who was making the decisions. But he went and talked to Martin, who was in his office for a while, and he came back and said, all right, we're going to keep doing it. And he says, but the deal was that Stan Lee was going to be involved in the covers.
Mm.
And this is something, I really enjoyed reading this. It was in those Dark Horse Conan reprints that they've been putting out, those trades. But he said that and this is true, some of the earlier issues that show Conan fighting a snake, it show Conan fighting a giant spider, you know, on the covers. And they said the next issue, it had I think it was the eighth issue. And that's the one I bought when I was a kid. But they said Conan had to fight a dragon. And in the book, he did fight a dragon, but it was kind of like a horned toad, a giant horned toad. And I guess that was the drawing on the cover. And Stanley says, no, this is going to have to stop. So he wanted to see what was in the issue. And Conan had to fight. It was the Keeper. It was basically Keepers of the Crypt. There was like all this
jewels.
Yeah,
I remember that cover. Yeah, that's a good one.
But yeah, and they had all those guards. He said, well, what you need to do. So Stan basically broke down the cover. Showed that you need to show these guards. You need to have Conan in the front seeing something. The girl looking at the gold. So he dictated it, they did it, and all of a sudden Conan started selling all over the place. I bought it.
And John Romita redid some faces on it, too. I think he did the girl's face.
Oh, did he really?
I think. I know it was Barry Smith. I think it was inked by Sal Buscema. That's, for some reason, I look at it and I think John Romita. Maybe I'm wrong.
That's one of my favorite covers. I mean, to this day, that one is why you said you remember it. And I saw it. I didn't see Marvel Comics much then, but I bought a Marvel comic. I can't remember what it was. But in the Marvel comic, it had, you know, it had house ads and had an ad for that Conan. I didn't know what Conan was. I said, wow, it's kind of a hippie character with a sword. And then I saw, but that cover just stayed with me. So I saw that on the stands and I bought it. And I was telling friends, I also had a book of from Beyond the Unknown, which fascinated me. And I'd always tell my friends about these stories, and when they come over to my house, I would pull that out to show it to them. Every single time, like 10 times, I'd pull out that From Beyond the Unknown to tell the people about these stories, and they'd look over at some, like, oh, wow! It was always that Conan. And they'd pull it out, and they'd start reading the book. Had no interest in seeing the one I was trying to show them. 10 times that happened. And so that's the power the cover really brought you in. Roy Thomas. But anyway, that's the thing with Roy Thomas. He, they kept the book going. Of course, it ended up becoming a big seller. But it was because of Roy Thomas's love for it. So I'm thinking he liked the X-Men, so that's why, we'll keep it. We'll just turn it to a reprint of book.
Okay, that was one of his favorites. Okay.
But he was the one that started talking about we should... The idea, according to Lynn Wein, was that Marvel Comics are selling really well in foreign countries. And Roy Thomas said, well, you know, what we should do is have a book that has international characters. And what we're talking about is characters from the countries that sells well. So it kind of, you know, be an interest to the people. And he was wanting to bring the X-Men back. So they made them international. At the same time, Roy Thomas said, you know, a neat name for a character is Wolverine. We should have a character called Wolverine. So Len Wein made up a character called Wolverine to put, you know, to fight the Incredible Hulk. And he said he made him Canadian because he thought, well, X-Men's supposed to be an international team. Maybe, you know, Wolverine could be in it. I could have a character in it. So that was all it was. And later, Len Wein said that when the book came out, nobody bothered to research what countries the book sold well in, the books are selling well in. So they just made Africa, Germany, Canada, you know, Ireland. He said, so it's kind of an app, but, you know, Roy Thomas wanted to bring the X-Men back, even though he didn't write them.
There you go.
But we went on a tangent on this. One thing I do want to bring up on Valerian and Laureline, I'm forgetting my point now. We were talking about, they went back to the, well, great, now I can't remember what it is. I'll add it to the show.
Should we take a break?
Oh, no, I'm sorry. It was the circles. We'll take it after. Circles of Power. Luc Besson made Bruce Willis a rocket ship factory employee. And but when they didn't get the financing for the movie, Mezieres and Kristen went back and did Valerian. They did Circles of Power. And Valerian and Laureline end up having to hire a taxi cab driver. He was kind of like this little elf guy in this taxi cab. Luc Besson fell in love with a taxi cab, and when he did that movie on The Professional, which is Leon in France, which is a really good movie, and it was financed by, you know, independently with French people. It was an international success, and I said, well, I guess you can do an international movie. So he got his financing for the Fifth Element, but when they all came back, he told Mezieres he wants to use a taxi cab, so he changed Bruce Willis from a rocket ship factory employee to the cab driver. And but that's where it came from, was Valerian. Anyway, highly recommended. It's a book I love. Went to see the movie a second time. Loved it just as
Have
much.
Have you bought it yet?
It's not out yet. Oh. Matter of fact, my birthday, I wanted to go to the movies, and I was really wanting to see Valerian. My wife is not the kind of person, we've already seen it. And she kept saying, what do you want to do your birthday? You go to the movies? What do you want to see? I don't know. I knew what I wanted. So the day of my birthday, she said, you said you want to go to the movies. Yeah, I do. What do you want to see? I said, well, I never told you because I knew you were going to sit there and say, well, I don't want to. And she kind of, you know, tightened up. And I said, but I want to see Valerian again. And her mouth was open like we've already seen it. And I said, that's why I haven't told you, because I knew you'd say that. I said, but I really want to see it a second time on the big screen. I really enjoyed it the first time. And it was killing her, but she finally thought, well, all right. So we went, And it was finished. Oh, honey, thank you very much. I love it. We're going to buy this movie. She said again. I said, yeah. She goes, oh, it makes so much more sense. The first time I was just so overwhelmed. Oh, you liked the first. Oh, I loved it the first time, but this one makes more sense. It's great. It's a great movie. Anyway, man, we talked a long time. It's music break.
Dimension can be found on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. If you like what you hear, you can subscribe, rate, leave a review, tell a friend, or like us on Facebook. Thanks for listening.
And we're back, and that was The Move with the song Brontosaurus from the album Looking On, I think it is. And I know that at this point the band had what's his face that you don't like, Mr. ELO guy,
Jeff Lynne.
Jeff Lynne was in the band, but he didn't sing on this song, and he was actually pretty good on these records. So there you go. I just started watching videos on YouTube. And they had a ton of videos of The Move, and I was like, okay, you know, watch it. I go, I kind of like this song. So there you go. We haven't played them before.
When I say that, I'm not really, I know, if you're too young to remember, Electric Light Orchestra, which eventually started to be called ELO, yeah, was a really popular band in the mid-70s. And then I actually liked them. I never bought any of their albums, but I liked them okay. And then it was towards the 80s, I grew to just hate these guys. And but Jeff Lynne, who was the leader and I guess songwriter singer of ELO, they always talked about the earlier band was The Move. And I've never heard anything about them, but was it like ELO or is his band, or was it on?
Well, here's the deal. The Move was originally Roy Wood, Carl Wayne, Bev Bevan, and I forgot who the other guys were. And then at some point, they became a four-piece, and then the lead singer, which was Carl Wayne, left. So then Jeff Lynne was in a band called the Isle Race, and Roy Wood called him and said, hey, man, why don't you come over with my band? And originally, he didn't want to do it, but he said, Roy Wood came back to him and said, look, I got an idea for an orchestral record, because The Move's dying out, and we're going to call it the Electric Light Orchestra.
Oh.
So then Jeff Lynne said, oh, I like that idea. He goes, but before we can get to the ELO, we got a contract to do one or two more Move records, and then we're going to do the ELO. So he said, all right, I'm more interested in that than that. So he wrote a bunch of songs for Looking On, and then he did another album called Message to the Country, which is both pretty good records. And at the same time they were doing Message to the Country, which they had to fulfill a contract, they were recording the first ELO record. So that's how that all came together. And then Jeff and Roy Wood left after their first ELO record because supposedly when they were touring, there was a technical problem with the guitars overshadowing the string instruments and they weren't getting it right. And it was a mess. And Roy Wood quit. And then, you know, as the years went on, Jeff Lynne figured out how to do it right. You know?
Yeah, Bev Bevan was always in the ELO.
Bev Bevan was all went with the ELO, and you know Roy Wood went on to do solo records and had some hits. You'll remember Roy Wood. I'll send you a picture because when he went solo, it was called Roy Wood's Wizard, and he had this crazy hair, and his face was drawn like with these. It almost looks like Kiss, but instead of being black and white, it was all colorful, and he looked like a. He looked pretty scary looking, but he was writing these Phil Spector songs or whatever. But if you look at Roy Wood, Wizard, that makeup, it looks to me like, what's that guy that directs the horror movies, House of a Thousand Corpses? Rob Zombie.
Oh, yeah.
Took a cue from him. Kind of, sort of. So we'll post these images on this show, but that's a little short history of The Move and the ELO.
I didn't know that.
All that kind of stuff.
Bev Bevan ended up going to the Black Sabbath.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought that was
funny. The ELO, after ELO broke up, he went to Black Sabbath for a couple of records.
Yeah,
and then
I was in the Philippines in 84, and I bought a Circus magazine on the bass, and it had a picture. It was the weirdest thing because the singer from Deep Purple was the singer for Black Sabbath.
Ian Gillan, that's right. Yeah.
And then Bev Bevan was the drummer. And I was reading that, and I showed it to this other guy that wasn't really that interested in rock. And I said, do these four guys look like they should be playing together? And he goes, yeah, they don't look. Bev Bevan, I mean, he looked like Richie Cunningham, a buff Richie Cunningham
in
this band. And the Deep Purple guy didn't really fit in either. And then they had there was an article about the album and a review about the album.
Born Again, I think it
was.
Yeah,
Born Again.
It had like a little devil baby or something on it.
And that's what there was some people talking in it, some other musicians saying, when I heard Born Again I realized I like Black Sabbath still. But then they also had a one page interview with Bev Bevan. And they said he left ELO because of Jeff Lynne's insistence on him playing electronic drums. And then it said in print, quotes, "I hate them," he says. A friend of mine reading it, "I hate them," he says. But I don't know. The way I kind of took it was Jeff Lynne was insisting on a lot of things, and these guys were getting fed up with it, and I don't know.
I know Bev Bevan, he's still around, and he still tours as something or another. And I think he angered Roy Wood, too, for some reason, so I don't know. But Bev Bevan? Drummer, yeah, something. Oh. He either took the Move name or something. I don't know. He pissed everybody. Yeah. Oh. But he's a great drummer, though.
Yeah.
And he was great in those two bands, and I hope they... Well, they were inducted. ELO was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame recently, and Roy Wood came along, and I guess Bev Bevan was there. I don't know. But that record, that Born Again, I remember seeing it and hearing a song from it. It wasn't bad. It didn't sound like Ozzy at all because it was Ian Gillan.
Mm.
But I remember people always used to rip that record, and now from what I read, people are kind of like, you know what? This always happens too. It's like, looking back 40 years ago, this isn't a bad record.
Yeah.
You know, it's like that's not bad. Maybe it wasn't recorded well. Maybe, but
is that the first one without Ozzy?
Maybe.
Well, that's
maybe.
It's. I guess that's the thing. It's a departure. Even though it's not a bad record, you're still, you're a Black Sabbath fan. Ozzy was. You can say what you want, but Ozzy was a major part of Black Sabbath.
Oh hell
you know?
Yeah! I mean. The heart of Sabbath is Tony Iommi's riffs and something, but Ozzy was like it was everything else, you know?
And
the rhythm section was amazing,
too. Yeah, I would say all four of those guys in that band were an identity to it, but, you know, you replace them with some other people, and it changes.
Scott Conner will know more about
this. Yeah, Scott.
He'll school us on all
I meant to, I didn't do it. Scott, after... two episodes back, he sent a really nice message to me.
Ian Gillan left, I think he left Black Sabbath after that record, and some guy called Tony Martin, I think, did vocals on a couple of more records. Again, this is stuff that I may have read. Scott Conner will clarify this and let us know exactly what's what. I'm not a aficionado of Sabbath, but I do like some of their music, and mm-hmm. You're looking at...
Well, I was looking, because I meant to copy I was going to read Scott's message over, but I guess it's been disarrayed.
And there was a really cool video of Black Sabbath from 1970 in France, and it used to be on YouTube, and it was really cool. I'm not sure if it's there anymore. Might want to check it out. Probably know about it. I don't know. Anyway, yeah.
Right. Well, one thing, I want to bring one thing up really quick. Actually, two things, and then we'll get into what Al's got.
Maybe we'll use that for another show.
Oh, no, I want to talk about that, too. Al mentioned these. I'd seen them in the store and didn't pay any attention to them. But what we're talking about is Jack Kirby. It's his 100th year, and we talked about some of the books that DC's been putting out, the Commandy Challenge, you know, and... They've got several. They got Darkseid. They got Mister Miracle. They got a bunch of books, which I'm not talking about.
These are the DC ones.
Yeah, the DC, and they're new stories off Jack Kirby's fourth book.
He got Sandman.
You know, I bought a few.
Rude did some work on one of them. Steve Rude did.
I have that right here. Commandy Challenge. But that's an issue of Commandy Challenge. They got something about Darkseid, which I bought an issue. They have Mr. Miracle that Tom King is writing, which I bought two issues, and we'll talk about that in another episode. It's really good. But Marvel, I was surprised. I saw a reprint of, I think, Avengers 4, where Captain America joins them, which is one of my favorite covers. And when I mentioned it, Al said, "Oh, that's the True Believers stuff." Really? Well, I was at Wilson's, and I've seen them on the wall. I never bought them, even though I liked some of those issues. But I ended up buying three of them just because I never read them. And that was Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D.
This is cool.
Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Oh, yeah. I've never seen
it. I've never read it. I've seen it in that Son of Origins one time, the Inhumans, I'm a big Inhumans fan.
That one I bought when I was a kid.
And but these things are only a dollar.
Yeah, man.
I bought three of them, and then $3? And I couldn't believe it. I don't think there's, some of them do have ads later, but these do not. You know, they have a house ad.
Oh, those are great.
But the back has a really nice, it's that Foom. I think it was from Foom. They had a Jack Kirby drawing of him at the drawing board with all the characters. And they say Jacob Kurzberg, born on August 28th, 1917, was known professionally as Jack Kirby and the King to fans and true believers. From Captain America to the Inhumans, Kirby's dynamic action and out-of-world concepts helped build the foundations for the Marvel Universe. In celebration of 100 years of the King, Marvel presents some of his greatest works in these special issues. These things are really nice. They tell a little bit of story in the front. In the Nick Fury, it tells the first story, how he comes to S.H.I.E.L.D., and a later story. These are greatness. The Inhumans issue, I've always loved the Inhumans. But they used to have a book called Amazing Adventures, The Inhumans and the Black Widow. It was a double feature. And I never, that book was older than I, when I was buying comics. But it basically has two of the stories that continue and have all these pinups that I remember they used to make blacklight posters out of in the back. Absolute greatness. And then I bought Ant-Man and the Wasp. And what makes this book to me so special was...
Man in the Anthill, right?
Yeah. Tales to Astonish, number 27, had the story The Man in the Anthill. And it was Henry Pym, Dr. Henry Pym, who was the Ant-Man. But he had a serum, he shrunk himself down, and ended up going an anthill. Of course, it was one of those Twilight Zone, you know, big monster movie stories that they, you know, they used to do. And it was kind of interesting because basically Marvel, when they started doing the Marvel superhero books, they were taking all these ideas from these old books and turning them into superheroes. They always said they had a horror quality to them.
Sure.
But I'd always heard that on Facebook, people talk about Henry Pym was in that old story, which you already knew, because Al knows all.
Yeah, right.
But I don't know. I just thought that was a really special thing, and it starts out with that story, and then it goes into Ant-Man, how it started.
See, that to me is weird, because it says art Jack Kirby and inking Don Heck. It sure looks like it's layouts by Jack Kirby and heavily inked by Don Heck, if you take a look at
it. I think that's exactly how it was. Stan Lee gave the plot, script was H.E. Huntley. I don't know who he is. But I was surprised at this, because I didn't know that Henry Pym was married to another woman.
I didn't either.
And I've never read these stories like this. I've seen references to it, but, you know, basically, they were after his wife and her father, who I guess they were from Poland. And, you know, this, all the old Marvel books was the Cold War.
Yeah. 61, 62, 63, and, yeah.
Yeah. And the Cold War started Iron Man and all these other people off. But he became Ant-Man, but he kept talking about a partner he could trust. And then he ends up meeting Janet Pym, because Janet Van Dyke, because their father was a professor, or Rich, I can't remember the two. But, they basically, right from the get-go, was talking about their, you know, they always had a romance, but he makes her the partner. I never knew that. That's right in the first, second issue of this. I don't know. I really enjoyed these books. Again, at Comics and Stuff, I went there and I bought two more, which I haven't got
yet. Oh, you got these at the...
I got these at Wilson's.
Oh, yeah.
But I bought Iron Man... And I got, which I already have, I bought the first issue of Devil Dinosaur.
Oh, you had those there?
And I bought the first issue of The Eternals, even though I already have it. But I guess I kind of like the fact that they're not just, they're not lazy. They're not just like throwing something in there, all the kids will get it. I mean, this one, like I said, the guy does a slight write-up at the front, which isn't anything staggering, but it's heartfelt. But like I said, I thought the Ant-Man was neat, how they put the origin, you know, the first part of it.
Yeah.
And
I mean, is it the origin or is it the prototype? Is it really?
Well, yeah, that's a better word, the prototype.
The prototype, yeah.
But I don't know. I find that fun. I like that kind of stuff, and it's on really nice paper. The Inhuman story, I never got to read. I'm happy I saw it. So like I said, they're a dollar. And
got to buy them.
I wish I would have bought that Avengers issue now. I've got it in a trade. But I see it now as just a dollar, and I wonder what else they put in it. If they put a story of an old, you know, Captain America story or what.
And some of these old Tales of Astonish, whatever, Strange Tales books, they had prototypes besides the Ant-Man for Doctor Strange and some other characters, too. Doctor Doom, maybe. They basically, like, used, they took ideas from those and they made them into...
Well, I'll be honest with you, and Al can attest to this. Anytime I see these where Monsters Drills, a creature on the loose, or any of those in the dollar box, I'll buy them, even though they're beat to no end.
Yeah.
And I've even found some reprints that Kyle Baker did the covers to. And I've been buying those. I've always enjoyed those. Even in the 70s, I used to pick them up. But there was a bunch of them. They did those for a long time. So they had a lot of... It's kind of like Lord of the Rings. You know, J.R. Tolkien had a lot of short stories and songs and everything else for that world that he made.
Remember when those were coming out? I wouldn't buy that many of them because it was just like, man, there's too many of them. They had the monster. They had Marvel was reprinting some of the giant monster ones. And then they did some of the Atlas horror books or whatever, too, as like Vault of Evil or Chamber of Chills and stuff like that. So, I would just get them occasionally, but I wouldn't buy that often.
Like I said, when I had pocket money, I'd ride my bike to the store, I'd buy a couple of comic books. And, I mean, I couldn't buy every one of them, but sometimes I'd buy a Fantastic Four, Rich Buckler drew, and I'd buy one of those, you know, Marvel horror books.
Yeah, and ride home, and
like I said, it really sucked you in. There were stories that really entertained me, and still do, and, but like I said, they had a lot of those stories. I read on Facebook, somebody posted that it's not quite this divided, but Jack Kirby did a lot more of the big monster stories. Steve Ditko did, too. But Steve Ditko did a lot more of the Twilight Zone type stories. And, of course, Steve Ditko did a lot of the giant monster stories, too. Tim Bubaugh and some of that stuff, you know.
Jack Kirby did a lot of the guy...
Yeah.
Yelling at the camera and pointing at the monster. Hey, look at there! You know?
Which is awesomeness.
Yeah.
One other book I want to bring up. I never thought this would happen. I saw it on a Facebook, and then I walked into Wilson's, and they had it, so I got it.
Yeah. I heard it's pretty good.
The reason I bought it, I saw that thinking, I never in a million years would have thought that would occur, but it's Wonder Woman and Conan. And I'm thinking, well, that's a bizarre crossover, but it's Dark Horse and DC.
Uh-huh.
And I picked it up because I saw the cover online, and then I looked through it. I liked the artwork, so I picked it up. The story is greatness, and it's not like shoving a square peg through a round hole. The story starts out, and it reminds me a lot of Braveheart, like Conan's father, which I've never, if they've ever told these stories before, they were never stories I read. His father was a blacksmith, you know, for the Sumerian tribe. And whenever you meet in council or whatever, you go somewhere else and you always bring a second. And he brought his son Conan, which I guess is about 12 or 14. But I guess his son killed a lion or something or a bear. And so he brought him as an adult. And when he showed up, there's a woman. Her name's not Diana. I can't. If you looked in the first page, Al, it'll have her name at the very bottom.
Wonder Woman's name?
Yeah.
Her name was Yana.
Yeah, Yana. But I thought that was clever. He sees her, and then she looks at him, and then all of a sudden, the second page, the story's the present day for Conan, you know, where he meets up. But and then later they keep having flashbacks of how, you know, when he met her, and she's kind of like royalty for that. I don't know. I have to say I bought it out of the novelty sake. It's really good, just like Al's friend said. So, I just want to get those out of the way. And Al, the music break brought something up that we talked about the last episode, but I guess you read it and you have questions.
Oh, did we talk about this last time? Because me and my friend were, again, going over this again. Because somehow or another, he bought like the, I guess DC did one of those books, they did a Sandman book, but they did this version of the Sandman, the middle one, right? This is not the...
This is the third one.
So the fourth one would be the one that Neil Gaiman did then? So there's that many versions of Sandman, okay.
When we were going through the dollar box of the Yancey, which still is one of those days in
history. The dollar box of the Yancey? Okay.
Yeah, we talked about it, and basically you're talking about comic books, and I said... The story to this version of Sandman, it came out in 1974, and that's Joe Simon and Jack Kirby did it as a special.
Issue.
Yeah, the first issue. Now Alfredo Alcala inked it, which was fantastic. But I hear different stories on it. The Golden Age Sandman, what was that man's name? Do you remember the character?
The guy with the gas mask?
Yeah.
No.
I know it because of, I've been reading Starman, that I can't remember that man, that writer's name now.
The writer of Starman?
Yeah, the ones they were putting out for Vertigo.
Oh, you mentioned him too a lot.
Yeah, and Scott Conner, I know in Virginia, is yelling, Don, you idiot, it's this! But he became a writer I really like. I can't name his name. But anyway.
I'll find it.
But they always refer to the Golden Age Sandman and that, and I always hear his name, but as you can tell, I can't think of any name. But... He was the Golden Age Sandman, the guy with the gas mask and the fedora hat and the green suit.
Yeah.
And then Jack Kirby and Joe Simon did Sandman kind of like Batman. He wore a yellow outfit with a purple mask and purple gloves. They had grappling guns, and he had Sandy, the Golden Boy, which was kind of like Robin in a yellow suit with red trim. But they had those grappling guns, and he had a sand gas gun or something to put people to sleep. And, I don't think that was the same man. There was a Sandman in that. But they basically updated him because of Batman. Well, this was the third one. It came out in 1974. And it was a Jack Kirby, Joe Simon special. He's in a yellow suit with a red mask, cape, and gloves. But it's not the same type of outfit. It's a different design. And it's more cosmic. And basically, it's telling the story of this boy on Dolphin Island that lives with his grandfather, which is a fisherman. And they get this creature, this doll he finds called the Werblink. And it's this kind of a green doll that's kind of a robot. It has scales on it, like amphibian. And the Werblink is kind of evil. It's like a Twilight Zone episode where he's telling the boy what to do and stuff. The grandfather tries to bury it. And he's always telling his grandson, he says, boys shouldn't play with dolls. And ended up, there's a character called General Electric, which I talked about last episode. I love that book. But he was the one making these, and there's all these plans. It was a really sideways story. It was fun. But Sandman was in this portal, and he had this big console, and he had in his tubes these characters called Brute and a character called Glob.
Right. Those guys there, right?
Yeah. Brute was this big guy in like a swimsuit with a mask. And Glob was exactly that. He was this little fleshy glob with arms and legs, and they're both in tubes. And they have their names on it. And there was a big spread of Sandman, you know, seeing this shipwreck. And Brute and Glob are saying, let him die. And he goes, Brute, Glob, stop talking. I got to help him. Well, Sandman could jump through this tube and enter our reality. And he come and help the kids. Well, it was just that one issue. And I remember it finished, and I liked it. Well, the book came out later. I guess there was four issues, I think.
James Robinson?
Yeah, James Robinson. Thank you, Al. Thank you. James Robinson was the writer. But, you know, when I always say you have something on the tip of your tongue, I wasn't even close.
I was the same way.
I was thinking Jeff Parker or something.
Oh, Jeff Parker.
But it wasn't Jeff. It was James Robinson. That's the one I was talking about. Thank you. But the second issue of Sandman, when it came out, Joe Simon was no longer involved. Oh, this is six. I guess there's more than six issues. But Michael Fleisher, who is a writer both Al and I enjoy quite a bit, but he wrote them. But the story changed because all of a sudden in the second issue, the grandfather died. And so they took the boy off of Dolphin Island. I remember he said, goodbye, Dolphin Island. he ended up living with, I guess, cousins, some distant cousins. And it turned into Cinderella. He wasn't treated well. And basically, all these things would happen. A Sandman would come and help him. And then Brute and Glob would do all of his chores. You know, it was always kind of a lighthearted, funny ending to it. But that was the book. I never understood why Joe Simon left the book. And I've heard different stories, and I don't know if any of them are true.
Fleischer took it over after.
Yeah, as I said, Michael Fleischer. But I've heard that Joe Simon was coming back to D.C., and he wrote that, and I guess the story was too Joe Simon silly, and they said it didn't sell, and so he left. And I was wondering why they continued it on. Well, they brought Michael Fleischer, and in those same stories, they said Jack Kirby only wanted to work with Joe Simon, but they said he was a professional, so he continued to do the book with, you know, Michael Fleischer. I just never understood why they killed the grandfather and had him move with these other people.
And I think the second and third issues, I downloaded them off some place, some site or something. The second and third issues were drawn by Ernie Chan.
Oh, really? Jack Kirby didn't draw them?
No. Oh. I have them. I've read them. It looks like he's doing a Jack Kirby style, but it's Ernie Chan, Chua, whatever, inked by Mark Rory. And then Kirby came at the end and finished off the six issues, and this is right before he went to Marvel, I'm guessing, yeah. Right?
He went to Marvel in 75.
So these ended in 76. So it must have been...
Okay, well, I guess 76 is when he left.
Yeah, this is the last one of that run, I believe, and this is 76.
But he must have gone back in 77 then, end of 76.
It says December, January, 75, 76, so there you go. And then after that was over, what then, I guess, in the 80s, Neil Gaiman made the...
Yeah. Well, I've also heard that Joe Simon, I guess they only planned on doing the one issue. And Joe Simon just came in to have some fun and do it. And then I guess that's another story I heard, that the issue sold really well and people liked it. DC said, well, we should keep this going. Well, Simon wasn't interested anymore. He did the issue. And I said this on the show, that the first issue was really strong. The next few issues I found second rate, but now I realize why, is that Jack Kirby didn't draw them. Okay. Mm-hmm. Right. It was a series I liked, and then Dallas lent me The Sandman by Neil Gaiman, which is completely different Sandman. But in that first trade, they show the different incarnations of him. And basically what they talked about was, in the beginning, there's the dreaming, which, you know, Sandman controls, and it's his world. But somebody captured him in some kind of a glass bubble. And they caught the Sandman, and the dreaming ended. And so all of a sudden other people, you know, the dreaming still kind of existed in a subconscious way. And that's when the original Golden Age Sandman started doing his work, trying to keep it going. And then they showed the Sandman and Sandy later. And then they showed this current Sandman from the 74. They had him in there. And it was funny, they showed him as he was a Latino. He was Spanish-speaking. And they basically talked about how his wife had to deal with his delusions. And they showed this typical current family with this you know, housewife. Oh, here he is again. Like, he was wearing a costume, and he had these imaginary friends, and he's doing all this stuff. But they were showing briefly. And in the last episode, I put a page up. It's kind of like a Winsor McCay looking page of this Sandman. I've always loved, this is my favorite of all the Sandmans. It's because that first issue was, to me, so special.
Oh, well, there you go.
And then, you know, like I said, but Neil Gaiman, the beauty to those stories were, he had a completely different Sandman, but he never forgot the old different versions, explained why they were there. And I've never read any more past that first trade. Mm. But I think he tends to bring them back sometimes and show some of it what happened. But
okay.
Anyway.
Well, there you go.
All right. It's a long episode, of course it is, because it's just me and Al. Anyway, and Scott, I apologize. I had your letter and I didn't read it. I'll do it next time. It's quite well. Anything else you got?
No, man. We've talked a lot.
Anyway, thanks for bearing with us. I hope you enjoy it. And in the meantime...
read more comics.
My name is Mao, and with me as always,
Dr. Morbius.
Some parts unknown.
Question mark.
This is the promo for Slow Robot A Go Go, the B through Z grade movie review podcast.
That's right.
If it's obscure and you've never heard of it and it's horrible, we're your men. We're your men. We're the dudes that are going to review it and talk about it. And you're going to be like, why would they talk about that? And we don't know either.
And then you're going to want to run out and get these movies and pay big money, Blu-ray money to get these movies because they're all great and you're all going to love them.
But anyway, go to bunchofdorks.com.